No, I haven't conceded anything.
Results from the recount for House District 40. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 12th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, preparing for potential disaster in the Aleutians.
And after that, you'll see all these politicians and people running around in their orange suits and clipboards and hard hats saying, well, we got to do something better. And all of that will be useless at that point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Barrow Representative Benjamin Nagyak says he is not conceding the Democratic primary to Dean Westlake.
No, I haven't conceded anything.
That's despite the fact that Westlake's lead doubled today from 4 to 8 votes over Nagyak in the closely watched recount. What remains to be seen is whether Nagyak will challenge the final results in court, and if so, whether that could change the outcome. Nagyak declined to say if he plans a legal challenge and referred further questions to his attorney, Seattle-based election law specialist Tim McKeever. In the recount, Westlake added 6 votes to his total, while Nagyak gained only 2. 2 of Westlake's votes and 1 of Nagyak's came from ballots that the computer scanner initially failed to count. In addition, Westlake gained 3 votes from question ballots from Ambler that were received after the Division of Elections certified the results. And both candidates gained 1 vote from Kivalina, where some voters mistakenly cast ballots in both the Republican primary and the primary for all other parties. Nagyak caucuses with the Republican House majority. Republican officials are concerned about the handling of ballots in the village of Shugnak. Voters were wrongly given ballots for both the Republican primary and the primary for all other parties. Westlake received 47 votes in Shugnak, and Nagyak received just 3. In addition, some Republicans in the North Slope borough and elsewhere have said election officials didn't allow them to vote in the Democratic primary or required them to file question ballots. Nagyak says he's concerned about it.
I have a lot of Republican friends in the district also, and especially here in the North Slope, and I've heard they were turned down with their ballots asking for a Democrat ballot, and they won't allow that.
The Democratic primary is open to all voters. Catherine Pfeiffer was observing the recount in the elections office in Juneau for the Democratic Party amid division of elections staff hovering over ballots, optical scanners, and printouts. She says she was impressed.
I think it was very well organized. The election staff was very congenial, very helpful, answered people's questions, very transparent process.
Nagyak's observers deferred comment to Nagyak. Friday is the deadline for an election challenge to be filed in Superior Court. Late last week, the Obama administration paused the development of an oil pipeline in North Dakota following protests by the Standing Rock Sioux and other tribes from around the nation. Standing Rock Sioux are afraid the pipeline could contaminate their water. Over the weekend in Anchorage, a group also gathered to protest the pipeline, but many of them said they weren't there to protest all oil development. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk was there.
About 60 demonstrators gathered in downtown Anchorage on Saturday to sing, dance, and carry signs. They were there to support the Standing Rock Sioux tribe in their fight against the Dakota Access oil pipeline. The demonstrators in Anchorage say the pipeline developer isn't listening to the Standing Rock Sioux's voices. But because oil is such a big part of Alaska's economy, some demonstrators said protesting the North Dakota pipeline wasn't as simple as being for or against oil. Kelly Reed organized the demonstration.
This organization, this demonstration, is not opposed to oil. Oil production on the North Slope has been very beneficial for Native Alaskans who live up there. However, what we are objecting to is a silencing of the voice of a people called the Lakota Sioux.
Gregory Nostein, a member of the Native Village of Wales, says he supports the Standing Rock Sioux because he feels Native rights are often ignored. But he's okay with oil development if it's done responsibly.
Being for or against the oil pipelines here in Alaska, they've been providing revenues for our state for years.
Ada Coyle and her daughter Ashley Dr. Lara were at the demonstration. Dr. Lara was wearing traditional regalia of the Kodiak Island Sukpiuk people. Coyle says protecting water should be the number one priority.
You can't drink or eat money, but the water is there. We need it to drink, we need it to cook with, shower with, to cleanse us, you know.
Pipeline construction is on hold for now, while the Army Corps of Engineers reviews its earlier decisions to allow construction near tribal lands. Tomorrow, a coalition of big environmental groups is organizing a national day of action, calling on President Obama to revoke the Dakota Access Pipeline's permits. That includes protests in Fairbanks and Juneau. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Every year, thousands of vessels move through Alaska's waters. If something goes awry, their cargo and fuel could end up in the ocean. Cleanup efforts for past groundings near Unalaska have proven difficult and costly. The city and Coast Guard want to be prepared. Zoe Sobel from Alaska's Energy Desk hopped aboard a tug participating in a rescue drill.
The U.S. Coast Guard and City of Unalaska will be conducting a safety exercise in Dutch Harbor Bay.
On one of the nicest days of the summer, the Coast Guard cutter Morgenthau needs help. The boat is playing the role of distressed vessel. A local tug slowly approaches its bow while crew members ready the emergency tow system. Horns blare and bang, one end of the rope is on the tug and the other on the Morgenthau. On both sides, people scramble to secure the lines for towing. Lieutenant Andres Ayure is coordinating the drill. He says the practice helps ensure everything is in working order.
If you don't exercise it yearly, then with some time, some of these components could start decaying or start to break down, and we wouldn't find out until we actually have an emergency, which is not when we want to find out.
The city purchased its first emergency towing system after the 2004 grounding of the Selandang IU. When that ship split in half in rough seas off Unalaska's coast, six people died and thousands of gallons of oil spilled in sensitive coastal habitat. If you ask conservation biologist Rick Steiner, it's only a matter of time before the next disaster.
And after that, you'll see all these politicians and people running around in their orange suits and clipboards and hard hats saying, well, we got to do something better. And all of that will be useless at that point.
As a member of the Shipping Safety Partnership, Steiner has helped institute some improvements in boating safety since the Selandang IU's grounding. The Marine Exchange of Alaska has added more than 100 monitors to track boats 24 hours a day. And last year, the International Maritime Organization approved shipping buffer zones in the Aleutians to keep vessels further from shore. But Steiner says there's still a lot to do. He wants better navigation aids, increased financial liability for shippers, and most important, all-weather rescue tugs.
Let's say you get this portable tow package on the bow of a disabled tanker out at Chimia. What then? You don't have an adequate rescue tug of open ocean, powerful thrust and capability to actually hook it to and render a save in most scenarios.
Steiner says the smaller, less busy Prince William Sound has 11 tugs. He'd be happy with three for the Aleutians, and he wants to use the $5 billion oil spill liability trust fund to pay for them. It's impossible to eliminate all risk, but Steiner says preventative measures like buying tugs would be economical. Oil spills are expensive to clean up and not very effective. Ed Page knows about the cost of oil spills firsthand. He spent 30 years in the Coast Guard, three of those cleaning up the Exxon Valdez spill.
3 years, $2 billion, 10,000 people picked up 10%. It's not a very good return on investment. So you want to say it's difficult? Yeah, that's almost an understatement. It's almost, you know, exercise futility. You got to give it a shot. Picking up 10% is better than picking up nothing. But still, prevention is clearly the way to go. There's no doubt.
Cleaning up spills in the Aleutians or the Arctic would be even more costly. Now Page heads up the Marine Exchange of Alaska, which works to improve safety by monitoring the locations of vessels in Alaskan waters. He says the size of Alaska's monitoring network is massive, 1.5 million square miles, larger than anywhere else in the world. The statewide tracking system provides automatic alerts anytime a ship slows down or gets too close to shore. But now, Page says larger vessels, some bigger than the Empire State Building, are traversing Alaskan waters. And he says there are no boats powerful enough to save them.
They've got 18,000 containers. And they carry a tremendous amount of oil. And if you took the containers off the deck and lined them on the dock end for end, they would go 60 miles. If that vessel gets in trouble, there's nobody can give them a hand.
The boats are too big to stop in Alaskan ports. Page says they're only passing through, just like the Selandang IU. The task of improving maritime safety is ongoing. Page says now they're working on a new device, a parachute ship arrestor that would work like a huge sea anchor to slow down and stabilize distressed vessels, providing more time for repairs or a rescue. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a successful, if premature, search and rescue mission.
Seems like maybe his partner got a little overexcited and jumped the gun a little bit.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
A man is dead after his float plane crashed Saturday into a residential neighborhood on Anchorage's hillside. Anchorage police have identified the deceased as 75-year-old James Hefty. He was the only person found on board. Emergency crews responded to the crash site around 4:30 Saturday afternoon on Crooked Tree Drive. The cause of the crash is currently unknown, and the National Transportation Safety Board is investigating. In the remote village of Ivanoff Bay on the Alaska Peninsula, one of the four residents went missing on August 30th. 66-year-old Alan Kalmakoff walked off and couldn't be found. Amazingly, after a lengthy search lasting almost a week, he was discovered alive on Labor Day. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Ivanoff Bay is considered more or less abandoned, but the folks in nearby Perryville keep ties to the four Kalmakoffs who still call the place home. Alan Kalmakoff, who one of his brothers describes as a gentle 66-year-old who has never been the type to stay home for long, wandered away from the others last Tuesday. His family says he's not the type to do a lot of drinking, but he may have been a little snookered that day. Wednesday came and went, and still no one had seen Alan. On Thursday, a call for help went out. On Friday, half a dozen volunteers from Perryville scoured the area. On Saturday, weather allowed two troopers to make the lengthy flight down to the village. Ethan Norwood was one of those state troopers, and he says he had no idea how challenging an area like Ivanoff Bay would be to search.
Because it's abandoned, so the whole village, what's not covered in very thick alder brush, is covered with chest-high fireweed and other grasses, so you can't see anything.
Every abandoned building and every trail were checked and rechecked Friday, Saturday, and again Sunday. The weather was foul. Kalmakoff had been missing a full 5 days. He wasn't dressed for the elements, had no food or provisions, and was of ill health. Norwood says optimism that he would be found alive was fading.
He was not equipped for the weather. He was in poor health and had poor mobility, not able to walk without a cane, and needed seizure medication. So after that many days, it was starting to look kind of grim. You know, he was up against a quite an insurmountable task of even surviving with all the bears and the wolves and just the inclement weather.
On Monday, they decided to search one more time, making use of some improved weather to beat the bushes again looking for clues. Miraculously, Norwood's partner, Sergeant Scott Quist from King Salmon, found Kalmakoff about a half a mile from his house in the brush, lying face down and not looking too well.
First thing he asked for was a cigarette. And then he just kept saying how appreciative he was that we found him. And he knew his family was missing him, and he wanted to get back and see him. Told us that he was a man of faith, and he never gave up.
Norwood says without his cane and with just one shoe, Kalmakoff had been crawling on his hands and knees to move around. He told troopers he'd had at least one bear come dangerously close and that he hadn't had anything to eat. He was taken back home and revived with some food and tea. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The search for an overdue hiker headed to the abandoned bus where Christopher McCandless died ended happily this morning. Denali National Park spokeswoman Catherine Belcher says 45-year-old Carlos Castrejon of Mexico was located walking along the park road.
By one of our ground crews who was en route to their search point. He's safe and sound, and a little bemused that so much effort was put out.
Belcher says 20 people were involved in the search for Castrejon, whose girlfriend reported him overdue returning from a solo 30-mile hike round trip from the Park Road to the Stampede Trail area bus and back. She says Castrejon hoped it would take 3 days, but terrain was a little rougher than anticipated.
The distance wasn't a problem. It was just the conditions on that route that he chose, you know, coming in through the park rather than Stampede Road.
Belcher says Castrejon left September 7th, but it told his girlfriend he might not return until the 13th.
Seems like maybe his partner got a little overexcited and jumped the gun a little bit.
It's the second time this summer that a search was launched to locate a hiker overdue on a trip to the bus. Last month, 22-year-old Matthew Sharp of Manitoba, Canada, was unable to hike out from the bus because of high water on the Teklinika River. He activated a personal locator beacon and was picked up by Alaska State Trooper helicopter. The trek to the bus was popularized by the Into the Wild book and movie about McCandless. Numerous hikers trying to reach the bus have had to be rescued, and one died trying to cross the Teklinika in 2010. The Museum of the Aleutians has officially reopened in Unalaska after a scandal closed the space for nearly a year. Last week, new executive director Neil Hitch announced the museum has set regular hours for the first time since last fall, when the former director resigned after items from the collection were found in her home. In his first month on the job, Hitch has reopened the museum gradually, allowing visitors during cruise ships and ferry stops, even though the building's technically been closed. So far, he says the museum has had more than 1,500 visitors.
In the first 6 weeks of this fiscal year, we are going to eclipse our visitation number for the entire last year.
The museum has hired 2 part-time employees to staff the front desk, and Hitch says he's looking for a full-time collections manager. He's also applying for grants to fund future exhibits. Alaska and national business and labor groups launched a media campaign Monday to keep Arctic areas in the next 5-year federal offshore leasing plan. 20 groups, organized as the Arctic Coalition, are urging the Obama administration to retain a Beaufort Sea Lease sale in 2020 and a Chukchi Sea Lease sale in 2022. A decision is expected before the end of the year. Arctic drilling faces strong opposition by environmental groups. They say industrial activity will harm wildlife in a region already hard hit by climate change, and that petroleum companies have not demonstrated that they can clean up a spill in ice-choked waters. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell canceled Arctic lease sales scheduled for 2016 and 2017. She cited market conditions and low industry interest.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message brought to you by Alaska PTAC.
A pair of Forest Service workers killed a charging brown bear near Sitka at the end of August. It was the third dangerous bear encounter in the Sitka Ranger District in less than a month. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Sitka District Ranger Perry Edwards says the pair, whose names will not be released, was doing a fisheries survey along Appleton Creek about 30 miles north of Sitka and only about 10 miles from where a wilderness guide from Uncruises was seriously mauled just over a week earlier. Edwards says the workers were making a lot of noise as they progressed about a mile up the stream bed when they saw a brown bear on the canyon wall about 50 yards ahead.
The bear saw them. immediately came charging down the hill at full speed. It was really brushy. The crew had enough time to back up from thick salmonberry brush to have a little clear opening, and the bear came through the brush and was shot about 30 feet away from the crew.
Edwards says brown bears at top speed move at around 30 miles per hour. His crew relied on training and muscle memory to avert a disaster.
The crew estimated probably less than 4 seconds from the moment they first saw that bear to the moment they fired the shot, the first shot.
Edwards says that the Tongass National Forest has annual training for employees in the use of both lethal and non-lethal bear deterrents, and in how to avoid potentially harmful bear encounters altogether. The bear proved to be a sow. She had two large cubs, both of whom were in trees next to her, and nowhere near the fish crew. Edwards, who is also a habitat biologist, suspects that sows over the last few mild winters may have produced more cubs than usual, and now, especially with pink salmon returns lower than normal, they're feeling stressed. Not many people make their way up Appleton Creek. Edwards says one possibility was that this bear was guarding the stream like it might guard a food cache.
Maybe that bear had been defending that fishing spot and was at the point where they were like, one more creature comes by my fishing spot and I'm going to give them a what for that they will always remember.
The shooting took place on August 27th. Forest Service dispatch notified Alaska Fish and Wildlife troopers. As with any so-called DLP, or the shooting of a bear in defense of life and property, the Forest Service surrendered the hide, skull, and claws to the state. Edwards says his fisheries crew performed this task using only a Leatherman multi-tool. Just 9 days before this incident, on August 18th, and about 10 miles away across Peril Strait, two uncruised guides were mauled leading a group of over 20 people in Sitco Bay. The guide at the front was medevaced south and is expected to recover. And on August 7th, former search and rescue captain Don Cluding shot a sow with a .44 revolver after it charged him and a hiking partner in Nakwasina Sound, the first time this lifetime resident and outdoorsman had shot a bear in self-defense. He also had only a Leatherman and a pocket knife to salvage the hide. Edwards says the reasons why these bears are charging are impossible to know and, in his words, irrelevant. Rather, he wants the public to be aware of their surroundings, make efforts to avoid bear encounters, and be prepared to deter a bear if necessary. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Restoration is finally complete for the last remaining traditional Haida longhouse in the United States. The Sunny Hat Longhouse in Kasan on Prince of Wales Island has been falling into disrepair for 50 years. KRBD's Maria Dudzek has more.
For the past 5 years, carvers have been working to restore the Haida Longhouse in Kasan. It is called Naiwan's, the Great House, though many know it as the Whale House for some of the interior carvings. The structure was built in 1880. In the late 1930s, the Civilian Conservation Corps commissioned local carvers to renovate the building. It is the last remaining traditional Haida Longhouse in the United States, but was not maintained from 1940 until 2011. Fred Olson is vice president of the Organized Village of Kasan.
For all of the Haidas, it is a cultural landmark. You know, it's near and dear to our heart. It's a part of our soul. And so as it decayed, we knew we had to restore it.
Olson says it was the family home of Chief Sunny Hat. Ownership then transferred to the U.S. government, and the land and building are currently the property of Kavilko Incorporated, a Native corporation created under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The restoration took 5 years. The lead carver was Glenn Stormy Hamar. Hamar worked with three apprentices, Eric Hamar, Justin Hendricks, and Harley Holter. Holter says as they began restoration, you could see remnants of the original house and the 1930s renovations. He says their intention was to keep as much of the original structure as possible, and they were able to retain about 80% of the existing building. Holter says the project was a unique and amazing experience.
I got to experience exactly what that longhouse experienced, just in a short fraction of the time that it's experienced. Like the weather it's had to go through, the vandalism. I got to just see a whole lot of things about it that I had never known, and I'd been going to that longhouse my whole life at that point. So once I got working on it, I just seen a whole new side of it.
Holter says he was surprised to find vandalism, which included bullet holes and graffiti.
I was blown away that somebody could just disrespect something like that much.
There are no plans to use the restored longhouse for any specific purpose. It has remained open over the years and is visited by locals and tourists. No meetings or events take place in it. Olson says he hopes things will remain the same, but also sees cultural opportunities.
One of the most inspiring moments of my life was being in there with all the dancers, and the life spirit in there was just amazing. And so I can imagine, you know, future culture camp type activities or this or that, but I hope that it gets to just be used how it is.
Olson says the project would not have been possible without the support of many individuals and organizations.
I would like to thank all of the people, Native and non-Native alike, who have shown us such an overwhelming outpouring of support and love for the Whale House. Thank you very much.
The restoration project was made possible through a partnership with the Organized Village of Kasan, Kavilko, and the Kasan Haida Heritage Foundation. More than $1 million was raised. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Zoe Sobel and Laura Craigle in Unalaska, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Mr. Eric Bork. Ben Matheson is our web editor, and Hillman produced tonight's show, and I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.